House Media.
A quick warning before we begin. This episode will contain the names of people and places that are entirely fictional, which I'm sure to mispronounce often. I hope you'll find it in your heart to forgive me. Enjoy the show.
Between the years when the oceans drank Atlantis and the rise of the sons of Arius, there was an age undreamed of, when shining kingdoms lay spread across the world. Hither came Conan, the Cimmerian, sword in hand. It is I, his chronicler, who knows well his saga. Now let me tell you of the days of high adventure.
Hey folks, welcome back to another episode of Hither Came Conan, the podcast that just doesn't feel safe without a sword around. And an axe. Possibly even a dagger or two. I'm your host. I'm the guy that pulls you along kicking and screaming as we tread them jeweled thrones under our collective feet. And so, I guess that makes me Steven.
Steven is my name.
And hey, guess what? That's right, it's time for another Dark Horse comic book. But first, I just have to say real quick, I don't actually own a sword or an axe or a dagger. I'm just trying to be facetious, folks.
Ha! I don't get it.
Anyway, this week, since we like to do these things in order, we're going to look at Conan issue number 4. This issue hit the stands on Wednesday, May the 26th, 2004. It sports a cover price of $2.99, and it is entitled Gates of Paradise. It was written by Kurt Busiek, with art by Kerry Nord and Thomas Yates, letters by Richard Starkings and Comicraft, and the colors were by Dave Stewart.
Into the boat!
Previously in Conan number 3. Conan and his BFFs, the Mighty Men of Asgard, track down and defeat the Vanarmen Raiders, who back in issue number 1 set their Asgardian village on fire. The Cimmerian and his friends have no time to celebrate, however, when they are attacked by giant, pale-skinned men who kill a lot of dudes before they beat Conan and the boys into unconsciousness, pile them onto sledges, and steal away with them. As issue number 4 opens, Conan, in the murky haze of his captivity, stirs atop his sledge. Clawing desperately at the fog that fills his brain, the Cimmerian tries to remember where he is and how he got there. He can remember a battle, some giant men who were not quite men, and betrayal. Sidjarl and Einar. A boiling rage rises inside him, but before it can become more than just a few sad little bubbles, a fist the size of a cow's head pops Conan a fresh one on the jaw, and darkness returns. But first, before the darkness can claim him fully, he catches a fleeting glimpse of a sprawling city. Over the following days, or weeks, maybe even a year, Conan finds himself drifting in and out of the murky darkness. One moment he's fighting for his life to the sound of applause, another moment he's being fitted for armor. It's during the armor fitting that Conan makes his first attempt to escape wherever it is he's been dropped into, but he doesn't even make it out of the room before a sorcerer pulls something from his robes that knocks the barbarian back once more into the darkness. When next the light returns, it comes with a voice and beauty. Conan's vision clears to reveal a figure, a super deaf hottie who has come to free the Cimmerian. Her name, she tells him, is Eosmini of Turin and chief house slave to Lord Ashtiana in Hyperborea. Conan grapples with the revelation, telling Eosmini that Hyperborea is supposed to be a land of wonders, of immortality, music, and eternal summer.
Oh, those things are here,
she tells the big Cimmerian.
Just not for us.
She then explains that Conan's dazed state is due to the influence of a drug known as the Yellow Lotus, and that in the 10 years that she's been a slave, she's never known anyone to overcome the power of the Lotus, and Conan has done so 3 times.
Steve, it's extremely badass.
She offers him a remedy, leaves that he can chew 3 times a day, that will keep the Lotus from affecting his brain. It'll take a few days for him to gain full control over his faculties, but once he does, she will come for him and the two will escape. And so Conan goes back to a life of forced servitude, discovering that Niord and some of the others are alive. But, as he was before the gift of the leaf, they are all mindless automatons under the spell of the Yellow Lotus. He also learns that while some slaves, those like himself, are chosen for the army, those that are too old or unfit are taken away. Where they go, Conan knows not. There are others, however, those that are strong but slow to learn. They are taken and transformed into the Gurnaki, the pale-skinned giants that had taken Conan and the others. The horror, unfortunately, doesn't end here, for it's not long that Conan and the others are taken to witness a day of farewell. Everyone has turned out, gathering at the edge of the city and assembled on terraces overlooking an unfinished stone bridge that stretches out over a dark abyss. It is here that Conan first sees a true Hyperborean. Tall, lithe, almost ethereal, pale skin brushed lightly with a lavender hue, and a nose that might look more in place on a bat or even a snake. She is the Lady Kiliarki, the head of her house. Conan watches as she strides purposely to the end of the bridge, the slaves and the army of her house trailing close behind. The Lady Kiliarki pauses for just a moment, her face serene as she takes a breath, and then hurls herself into the abyss below, followed closely by the rest of her house, slaves, army, and all. The Sumerian tries to keep his face from showing the shock that he's feeling as he remembers the words of his grandfather.
And when they tire of endless peace and beauty, they leap from the highest cliffs in the land, leap into the winds to be united with their gods.
Sometime later, Conan meets with Iasmini in secret, and he asks her about the ceremony, more specifically, why the slaves and the rest of her house jumped as well. She explains that the Hyperboreans consider their homes and all in them as a part of themselves. Their slaves give them life and join them beyond it.
That is messed up.
Incredulous, the Sumerian tells her that he's going to need more of the leaf, that he won't leave Hyperborea without Niord and the others. She's not happy about it, but she agrees. Then, because they are both super deaf hotties, they jump into bed and they make sweet, sweet love.
No way, gross.
Over the coming days, Conan begins grinding up the leaf and putting it in his BFF's food. At night, he explores the Hyperborean city. In the bowels of Hyperborea, amidst the stench of decay, Conan confronts the grotesque truth of their existence when he discovers that people, the slaves who are old, weak, or sick, basically those that the Hyperboreans deem as useless, are being sacrificed, and through a combination of industry, science, and magic, their souls are harvested and used to power the magic that controls the weather and allows the Hyperboreans to live forever. One such useless slave strapped down on a nearby table is Old Gorm, the Icer Tracker. Well, Conan has had enough, and though unarmed, starts kicking some ass and killing some folks. Meanwhile, in the palace above, Iasmini attends to her master, Lord Ashtiana. She offers him grapes and pomegranate seeds, but Ashtiana declines, finding the idea of chewing, of taking in sustenance, to be oh so tedious.
This is boring.
A servant then rushes in to give Lord Ashtiana the news of an intruder in the lower dungeons who has killed three people. The Lord, in a most lackadaisical and apathetic way, decides that he should probably do something, and so, using a bit of magic, sends his pride of lions into the depths of the palace to deal with the intruder, who, of course, we know to be Conan.
I get to fight the lion!
With the lions dispatched, Ashtiana comes to the realization that he is at fault for allowing such a transgression to take place below them, that he has not been looking after his house the way he should, and that the only logical reason for such a misstep is that he no longer cares. Furthermore, if he no longer cares enough to keep his house in order, then logically, he tires of life. And so, as the issue ends, Lord Ashtiana tells Yasmini to make the arrangements as their day of farewell is upon them. All right, so as promised, I wanted to talk a bit about the Hyperboreans in this episode. And, well, there's a lot of information out there, and most of it just made my head go all kinds of swimmy. But really, I just wanted to answer a few questions. Looking at the Hyperboreans from Conan the Barbarian number 3, Twilight of the Grim Gray Gods, the Marvel issue, and then looking at the Hyperboreans of this Conan issue, Conan number 4, Gates of Paradise, I want to know why they're so different. I mean, if their style of dress had changed or even the way they wore their hair, I probably wouldn't have even blinked. I just, you know, think about the Men of Asgard and how they looked in Conan the Barbarian number 1 from 1970, and then compare that to what we've seen of them so far in this Dark Horse run. That's not the sort of change or difference I'm talking about. The thing I'm trying to work through is that the Hyperboreans of the Marvel world look like regular barbarian people, no different than Conan or the Men of Asgard. The Hyperboreans of the Dark Horse world, however, they're all pale, long-limbed, 7-8 feet tall. They got no noses, or their noses are pushed in. They live forever, and they are steeped in supernatural mysticism. And I just want to know why such a drastic change was made. My first assumption, of course, is that Kurt Busiek just made his Hyperboreans more true to how they were in the Robert E. Howard stories. Yet, I can't find any evidence of that. I mean, while I didn't take the time over this past week to reread all of Bob's Conan stories, I did take a PDF that came along with the Audible version of Conan, the Sumerian Barbarian, the Complete Weird Tales Omnibus, and I used the Find feature to grab every instance of the word Hyperborea in those 18 stories, as well as Bob's essay, The Hyborian Age. And I could only find 3 snippets that mention the physical characteristics of the Hyperboreans. First, from the essay, The Hyborian Age.
The ancient kingdom of Hyperborea is more aloof than the others, yet there is alien blood in plenty in its veins, from the capture of foreign women, Hyrcanians, Acer, and Zamorians.
Next, from the Tower of the Elephant.
There was a giant Hyperborean renegade, taciturn, dangerous, with a broadsword strapped to his giant, gaunt frame.
And then finally, from Black Colossus.
They were men of many races and many crimes. There were tall Hyperboreans, gaunt, big-boned, of slow speech and violent natures.
And that's it. Actually, that's not true. There's also this bit from Conan.com on their page talking about Hyperborea.
The folk of Hyperborea are a strange and fey lot, a surly and dangerous people despised by most in the north for their wanton slavery and habit of waging war upon those who share borders. Their land is as bleak and cold as Asgard, though the southern reaches of the land are more favorable. From many captive foreign strains, the Hyperborean bloodline has become mixed, but they are still a distinct people, the tallest by far in the northern continent. Gigantic and blonde are the Hyperboreans, prone to gauntness and light eyes, and there is a crudeness to their appearance, a big-boned and rough-hewn sort of mien that is disquieting, as if they are a cruder sort of folk than those from other lands. As a people, they are oft taciturn and sullen, boastful and careless with their words. Suitably, their language is coarse and thick. They speak slowly, their voices generally deep and rumbling. And if any member of that race showed joy, it was a grim and mirthless sort of celebration.
So, really, where did this Dark Horse version come from? I can only assume that Kurt Busiek made the change on purpose. I just don't know why. And here's the thing, folks. While I can't explain why, I needed to know.
I got to know!
And so I reached out to Kurt Busiek on Blue Sky, and I simply asked,
I'm hoping you might answer a question for me. When you were writing Conan, what was your inspiration behind making the Hyperboreans as they were? I may be looking in all the wrong places, but they seem to be much different than those from the Bob Howard stories. I'm putting together an episode for Hither Came Conan, and while I'm not as down on Conan lore as I'd like to be, the podcast is all about getting me there. But from what little I've been able to find, your Hyperboreans are rather unique compared to the Marvel Conan universe and the Robert E. Howard originals.
So I clicked that sucker into existence, and then I waited. But as I waited, I got pretty bored. And so I decided to try and do a bit more research, which only goes to show how obsessed I was with this one stupid question. Because, yeah, more research.
I hate research.
Regardless, I bent over my computer and performed one more Google search. And wouldn't you know it, I learned that Hyperborea actually comes from Greek mythology. The name in ancient Greek means beyond Boreas. Boreas, by the way, was the Greek god of the cold north wind, storms, and winter, meaning that, really, one could argue that the literal translation of Hyperborea is beyond the cold north wind, which is pretty cool when you consider that here in this Dark Horse Conan universe, Hyperborea is located in the far north, farther even than Asgard and Vanaheim. It's in a frozen wasteland, but it is protected from the cold, making it somewhere beyond the cold north wind. In fact, while the Greeks believed that the Hyperboreans inhabited a sunny, temperate, and divinely blessed land, in many versions of the story, they lived north of the Riphean Mountains, often considered back then to be the northern boundary of the known world, which shielded Hyperborea from the effects of the cold north wind. Furthermore, legend says that Boreas, god of the cold north wind, fathered three giant Hyperborean priests by Kione, a snow nymph, and his daughter, and that they each stood 6 cubits high, or in other words, they are about 9 feet tall. It's because of this, along with the writings of Diodorus Siculus, an ancient Greek historian from the first century BC, and a guy who, by his name only, makes me feel like he didn't smell all that great. Well, legend has it that the rulers of Hyperborea, the kings they called Boreades, were giants that stood up to 10 feet high. So yeah, at that point, I was beginning to build a theory that Mr. Busick took most of his inspiration for the Hyperboreans from ancient Greek mythology. And at the time that I was coming to this conclusion, Mr. Busick answered my question, stating,
"If I remember correctly, and it's been a long time, the only time Howard brings a Hyperborean on stage is in the Tower of the Elephant, where we see a giant Hyperborean renegade. That's why I gave them giant slave soldiers, so the renegade could be one of them. But I didn't want to assume that had Howard written about Hyperborea, wait, I think he mentioned Hyperborean witches somewhere, he'd have made it just another country. He had his Northmen in Asgard and Vanaheim, so these guys would be at least Scandinavians. But he also got the name from the Greek legends. So I looked up what he'd know about Hyperborea from what he'd read to see if I could figure out a distinctive approach he might have made based on those legends. Most of what I used, purple immortals who die when they get bored with life in a land beyond the north wind, was extrapolated from what he might have read and wanted to use. I think he also wrote about how the Nordic tribes spread across the continent, except that the ancient Hyperboreans had resisted them, which made me think they should be different. So magic, immortal, not merely north, but beyond north, that was my foundation."
He then comes back a little bit later and continues,
"I looked. In Conan number 3, Conan talks about what his grandfather said of Hyperborea, which is pretty much straight from Greek myth. And in issue 5, we see the truth, which is a mixture of Howard's Hyborian Age history, the Greek myths, and if I remember correctly, some more recent crypto myth that has been spread by charlatans of a generation before Howard. I don't want to say that it was Madame Blavatsky, but it was from people like that. And it was still part of esoteric writings that Howard could have seen. Much of what Howard used to build the Hyborian Age was a mixture of myth with then-current racial drift theories, plus esoteric writings of recent times. I wanted to take the same approach, stick to what he said, and add to it with the sort of thing he'd have known and used, assuming that he'd had the chance to flesh those cultures out.
I looked up Madame Blavatsky, by the way, and yeah, that's a rabbit hole I'm not willing to go down. Not at this point. However, I wasn't done with Mr. Busick. Hither Came Conan will return after these messages.
At To the Batpoles podcast, we look at the many sides of our favorite hero, Batman. For example, Encyclopedia Batman.
It's the basic formula for escaping from the Siamese human knot. I just recalled it.
Civic Responsibility Batman.
Only a criminal would disguise himself as a licensed bonded guard, yet callously park in front of a fire hydrant.
Impish Humor Batman.
Look at him, Robin. That crooked bird's going crazy.
And more. See if you can identify other sides of the Caped Crusader, and then join us at To the Batpoles podcast, available wherever podcasts are found or at tothebatpoles.libsyn.com. Batman has many sides, but can we trust him to save the day?
You can be sure, if it's Batman.
And now, back to Hither Came Conan. If you recall, in the previous episode, the one in which we talked about Conan number 3, I postulated that Conan's remark regarding his horned helmet having a sentimental value to him was a nod to the helmet Conan wore in the first 6 issues of the Marvel run, thinking that, hey, he's wearing a horned helmet at the outset of both the Marvel and the Dark Horse run. That can't be a coincidence, right? Well, I asked Mr. Busick that very question, saying,
one last thing, if you will indulge me. In issue 3, Conan says that the battered horns on his helmet have a sentimental value to him. Is that a nod to the horned helmet Conan wore in the first few issues of the Marvel run?
His response?
No. I think the horned helmet comes from a Howard description. Then again, I may be misremembering. But in Man-Eaters of Zamboula, Conan says, break the neck of a wild Cimmerian bull before you call yourself strong. I did that before I was a full-grown man. We told that story in the Born on the Battlefield arc, and I like to think the horns on his helmet are the horns from that bull. I'm not sure Cary Nord and Greg Ruth drew them to look the same, but still, I think that's where the horns came from.
So yeah, that was my theory. But here's the thing. Realizing at that point that in Conan the Barbarian number 1, the new series from Titan Comics and Heroic Signatures published in August of 2023, Conan, in his very first scene, is wearing, wait for it,
wait for it,
a horned helmet.
No way.
Now my Hyperborean obsession shifted to a Conan wearing horned helmets obsession, and so I took Mr. Busick's answer to my helmet question and, doing a quote repost, added Jim Zub to the conversation, asking,
what about you, Jim Zub? I find it curious that in the first issue of the Marvel run, the first issue of the Dark Horse run, and now the first issue of the Titan run, all have Conan wearing a horned helmet.
Quite a coincidence, don't you think?
At this point, unfortunately, as I am preparing to record this episode, I have yet to receive a response. The Born on the Battlefield story, by the way, takes place in Conan number 8 from September of 2004, which, we may talk about, we may not. I haven't quite decided. I mean, I am currently contemplating extending what was originally going to be just 6 episodes, you know, Conan 1 through 6. But I feel like we can't talk about issues 1 through 6 without talking about issue 7, which does tie in. After all, the trade paperback collection, Conan Volume 1, The Frost Giant's Daughter, and other stories, doesn't contain just the Zero issue along with issues 1 through 6. It also contains 14 pages from issue 7 as well. So yeah, I'm thinking our 6 episode run will likely turn into a 7 episode run. And frankly, because it was brought up here in this episode by Mr. Busick, no less, we might as well kick that up to 8 episodes and talk about Conan number 8. It is a standalone story, and the arc that follows, starting in issue number 9, is The God in the Bull, which we talked about back in the Conan the Barbarian number 7 for Marvel 1971, The Lurker Within episode, back on June 30th, 2023. So yeah, that would feel like a good place to step away from Dark Horse and then get back to, I don't know, another couple dozen Marvel issues. What do you say? Until then, we're not quite done here with issue number 4, which means that it's time for Steven's favorite bits. So the cover for this issue, just like all the others, was done by Joseph Michael Linzer, and it depicts Conan on his knees in chains with who I assume is Lord Ashtiana standing above him, though this guy has a nose. So, I don't know, I'm guessing there wasn't a lot of communication going on between Kerry Nord and Linzer in regard to the look of the Hyperboreans, other than to just say they were tall, thin, and pale. Or maybe Nord added the no-nose bit too late for Linzer to make the change on the cover. Who knows? Regardless, I actually really like this cover, especially how Conan, who, like I said, he's in chains, he's on his knees, but he is struggling like hell to free himself. You know, you say to somebody that, hey, here's a cover, somebody on the cover, they're on their knees, they're in chains, and you might often picture that that certain someone is in a defeated, submissive sort of posture, but not Conan, no way. He's not just going to sit there and take that kind of shit. Getting into the issue, again, I hate to just freaking sound like a thing that, I don't know, repeats itself a lot, but God, the art is just beautiful in this series so far. Kerry Nord, Thomas Yates, just fucking incredible. I just love, I mean, really, if we're going to go by the art alone, every page in this issue and every page from issues 1 through 4, even the 0 issue, every page is my favorite bit. But that would make for kind of a boring segment here. So when we open up the issue, once we get past page 1, we get the title page, which is a 2-page spread. And one of the panels has Conan standing side by side with the other slaves. And there is a dude we see. We can only see the dude's back, and he's talking to them. And Conan, I don't know, man. It's just such a small panel. It's such a small moment, but I just love the way Conan looks in that freaking panel. I can't explain it. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 panels inset on this 2-page spread, and it's the second panel, and just love it. Love it oh so much. We turn the page, and Conan is fighting in the arena. He's kind of going in and out of consciousness here. The whole bit about, or the whole point, or the whole thing that's going on during these moments is Conan is a slave. He is being mind controlled. We learn it's from this substance called the Yellow Lotus, and it allows him to move, and he senses, he can hear, he can smell, he can taste, he can fight. Instinctively, he still has the fighting skills that he has always had, but he's doing so in kind of a fugue state. And as they point out later in the issue, he breaks out of this fugue state 3 times before the lady Yasmini, if I'm even pronouncing that name correctly, before she kind of catches wind of it and realizes that this is the guy that's going to help me escape. But during one of these quick, lucid moments, he is fighting in an arena. He has just cut some dude's head off. That's a great panel. And then suddenly there is applause all around him. And he doesn't like it. He doesn't like the applause. There's something about it that just isn't good. It's wrong. And I think the word they used here is that it's mocking his triumph. And the second panel on this page, he cuts the guy's head off in the first panel. And the second panel, he's standing there holding the bloody sword, and he's looking up into the stands because the applause has, you know, erupted all around him, and he looks up in the stands, and God damn, that's another great panel. That is one of the more perfect panels in this issue. If we go to the next page, the moment where he is being fitted for armor and these guys are talking about him like he's not there, because as far as they're concerned, he's not there. He's just an automaton. This is the second time he kind of breaks out of that fugue state. And the second panel of this page, when he's saying, Neiman, take me, but I will not be prodded and poked. That panel, his bulging eyes, I mean, it's literally a shot of his face from the tops of his, I guess, steely thews that go down into his shoulders and to midway up his head. It's just, again, another perfect panel. And then the panel below that, where he tosses the guy away from him, the way that is, I don't know if that's coming from the way it was penciled, the way his face is kind of blurred out, but we can see his mouth. It's a great panel. The splash page of the Hyperborean lady leaping from the bridge and her slaves following her. That's a great page because no one who is falling off of that bridge, there's one, two, three, four, five, looks like five of them are in midair and there's one stepping off the bridge. None of them look like they're struggling in any way or that they're afraid. They're just simply stepping off the bridge. And it's a nice looking panel. The next page, Conan, the look on Conan's face, again, another great panel. Conan, his eyes are kind of bulged out, his eyebrows are arced. It's a great panel. But then we get to the private moment between Conan and Yasmini, and good Lord, hubba hubba, you know, that's a wonderful page. There's this, the fabric that they have on Yasmini, or again, however you pronounce her name, the way that it's drawn and then colored to be translucent, but only in certain places. It's like the way it falls upon her skin and it's like where it touches her skin, you can see through it, but where it's not, you know, if there are wrinkles, so it's not touching her skin, it's, you see more of the fabric. It's beautiful. And I have to give that up, I think, to Dave Stewart more than Carrie Nord, I would assume. But that first page, there's two pages there. Well, let's see. Three pages in total of their private moment together. The first of the three might be my favorite. The third one, though, is a great, great page as well, especially when Conan has demanded that she give him more of the leaf so that he can free his friends, which is another one of my favorite bits because it shows the character of who Conan is. He's not just going to leave this place. If there's a way that he can take Njord and the others with them, he's gonna. These are his brothers as far as he's concerned by this point. They had his back. He had their back. They fought side by side, back to back in battle. And he's not going to leave them to this kind of fate. She doesn't like that. She doesn't think it's a great idea because A, it's going to be harder to get more, you know, the more people that they have, the more people that they try to sneak out, the harder that's going to be. Plus, it means she's going to need to steal more of this leaf, which may go noticed. But in that third of the three pages, the very first panel where Conan's getting in her face and he's telling her that if she wants his help, the price is the leaf for his friends. And if that's unacceptable, he's going to leave anyway. He'll just find another way. The second panel is this look on her face. There's no words there. This look on her face as she contemplates what it is he's saying. And she's got this fear in her face. Like maybe she understands that what he's trying to get at is he may use her in a way that harms her to get out. Like maybe he'll turn her in. He'll use her as a shield. He'll use her as a distraction. But in panel three, she's thought it over and she realizes that, yeah, in the end, he is still her best bet at escaping. And so she goes from fear to this, okay, big boy, you got yourself a deal, but I can't help noticing how sexy we both look because, you know, not only is she wearing this thin, transparent gown, he's standing there in nothing but what is basically a G-string, and they both look pretty good. And, yeah, they're going to spend a little time together in a sexual way. Conan creeping about the bowels of Hyperborea and coming across this room with these machines and learning that the Hyperboreans have been killing the old and the infirm and basically using their souls to power the magic that makes everything in Hyperborea the way it is. It controls the weather. It makes the Hyperboreans immortals, basically. And then at the same time, realizing that one of these slaves that is ready to be sacrificed, that's ready to be killed, is Old Gorm, the Icer tracker that Conan has spent the last few weeks with, learning about wilderness tracking. And, you know, somebody that he probably considers to be like a grandfather or an old uncle. And here he is dying on this slab, and he hasn't learned exactly what's going on yet. He comes in, he sees Gorm. Gorm is strapped to a table. Gorm looks up at him and very feebly says his name. There are two guards there and a guy in robes and a hooded mask. And that guy is known as an extractor. We don't learn that until later in the issue, but the guards attack. One of the guards, in one of those moments that are always funny in books starring characters like Conan, When the extractor tells the guards to kill him, one of these guards says,
"Worry not, Bartak. He's not even armed."
Which, you know, has never stopped Conan. Conan is there wearing just a Hyborian Speedo, no weapons, against two guys in armor with swords, and he kills them both. It's a pretty amazing sequence. And then he takes one of their swords, realizes that by this point, Gorm has now died. And so he demands to know from the extractor what's going on. And as the guy is explaining to him about these machines, about killing these people, about using their souls, Conan, you can see, is just getting angrier and angrier, and the rage is just filling inside of him. And the guy, before he starts his explanation, he starts begging for his life.
"Please don't kill me. I'm a slave as well. The lords, they assigned me this duty."
And then he tells the story, and Conan, he doesn't give a shit at that point. This guy may be a slave, but Conan, being who he is, I think if you read between the lines here, Conan is thinking, what if I had been put in this guy's place? The guy's obviously not drugged. He knows what he's doing. Yes, he's a slave. Yes, he's being forced into it. But I think Conan, put in this same position, would fight like crazy to escape. He would not do this, and he would die fighting before doing this. And this guy obviously chose a different route. And so Conan just simply walks over to him, grabs his head in his hands, and snaps his neck. I think the last bit here that I'm going to talk about is just the look of Ashti Anna. I mean, they're immortal, but he looks old. And I wonder if that's why their noses are kind of pushed in, because he looks gaunt. It looks like the skin is just hanging off of his bones.
Hey, your skin is hanging off your bones.
He also looks just super bored. You know, one of those super rich, super powerful people who have everything in the world. They need for nothing. Anything, any stupid little thing that they think of can be and will be brought to them. And eventually they get bored with it all. And that's who he is. And the Hyperboreans take it to the next level because they are, in essence, immortal. So when their boredom becomes so much that they just can't even stand existing anymore, the whole idea of existence, they find tedious. That's when they walk off the bridge. And Ashti Anna, after sending these lions, which look pretty sweet, after sending them after Conan, that's when he makes the decision that it's time to set up their day of farewell. And that's quite the cliffhanger, because what that means is, of course, Yasmina will take the walk as well. So not only do we have Conan in danger, down in the dungeons, one man against immortal wizards, lions.
I gotta fight the lion!
Giant fighting mutant men. He is then going to have to figure out how to get out of there alive, get his friends out, and Yasmina before Ashti Anna takes her and the others and walks off that bridge. This might be my favorite of the four issues so far. This one issue is my favorite of the four. And part of it, I think, is because everything up to this point, Conan in the north with the Icer, fighting the Vannermen, Frost Giant's daughter. You know, I feel like I've seen it all before. Granted, not in this fashion and not told in this way. That helps. But we have suddenly gone from this northern Viking barbarians against barbarians fighting in the ice and snow adventure to this just strange, fucked up world of tall, purpley, pale, immortal wizards. It's great. It's a great issue. And I've read it before. I've read issue 5 before, and I've read issue 6 before, but I don't quite remember how everything falls into place after this. And I am super, super looking forward to getting to those moments. But for now, folks, those were my favorite bits, and I have nothing else to say about this issue.
Everybody out!
Next week, we're going to continue with the Dark Horse run with Conan number 5 from June of 2004, Ashes of a Great Fire, I think. I mean, I'm fairly certain by the time this episode goes out on the main feed that Conan the Barbarian issue number 9 from Titan will not have been released yet. In fact, if I've done my calculations correctly, Conan the Barbarian number 9 will release the week after this episode goes up on the main feed. Until then, keep your swords close by, never stop treading them jeweled thrones, and most importantly of all, be nice to each other. Bye. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Hither Came Conan. Questions and comments can be directed to feedback@hithercameconan.com or come join us on social media. Just look for @ConanPodcast on Twitter and Blue Sky and @HitherCameConan on Instagram, Threads, and Facebook. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate the show over at Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. Donations to the show can be made at donate.hithercameconan.com or become a member of the Super Secret Steven Society and get episodes early and ad-free. Join now using the link in the show notes or go to secretsociety.hithercameconan.com. Memberships start at just $1 a month.
Many wars and feuds did Conan fight. Honor and fear were heaped upon his name. In time, he became a king by his own hand. This story shall also be told.
All right. Here we go. Don't know why I am talking like this.
Here we go. Woo. Okay. Hey, folks. Wow. Right off the bat, Conan and his BFFs, the Mighty Men of Asgard, track down and defeat the... A boiling rage rises inside him. Ashtiana. Ashtiana. Iasmini. Her name, she tells him, is Iasmini of Turan and chief house slave to Lord Ashtiana. Iasmini. Her name, she tells him, is Iasmini of Turan. Her name, she tells him, is Iasmini of Turan and chief house slave to Lord Ashtiana. This is a stupid fucking sentence. Her name, she tells him, Iasmini of Turan and chief house slave to Lord Ashtiana fucker. Would you guys knock it off?
Just don't think I can move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
How could you let this happen, Steven?
Enough talk.